Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
On this episode, I'm hosting Winter Mead, who has worked in financial services for a decade, investing approximately $900 million across 80 private equity and venture capital firms as a limited partner, specializing in venture capital. Currently, he is a CEO, co-founder, operator, a cohort-based training program for emerging VCs. Before becoming an investor, Winter Mead worked in the technology world at three different angel and venture capital finance startups. Winter has also involved in two leading industry organizations, the National Venture Capital Association and Institutional Limited Partners Association. And in his spare time, helps teach courses at Stanford University focused on entrepreneurship and venture capital. He is also a chartered alternative investment analyst, which is a professional designation for those specializing in alternative investments, such as venture capital. Last but not least, Winter is the author of How to Raise a Venture Capital Fund, the essential guide on fundraising and understanding limited partners.
My background is mainly in institutional investing. I've been an LP for over the last decade now. I began my career at Hall Capital Partners, founded by Katie Hall in San Francisco, where I was on the private equity team, investing into a number of different private equity strategies, including buyout, growth, distressed, and venture capital. I obviously became more excited in venture capital over the 4 years I was there and transitioned to SAP, the large enterprise software company based out of Germany. And they were building out a fund-to-funds practice, a fund-to-funds strategy to invest into other VC funds. And I think this practice has become more common today, almost where it's commonplace. But I think at the time when it was created, a little less than a decade ago, this was more of a novel strategy. And so it was interesting for me to join there, given it was investing plus building, like the actual process of building out a new strategy and a new fund at an existing platform where there were best practices and institutional best practices to learn from. That was very exciting for me. So I joined there in 2014 and spent upwards of 5 years building out that practice, both from the investing side and from the fund building side, and also helping implement the co-investment strategy there. So it's all very interesting, all kind of a lot of good learning, a lot of good perspective building. And I think if there's a general arc to kind of where I find myself today, it's starting with investing across the gamut in private equity and understanding different strategies, and actually being at a firm that was investing across multiple asset classes and sitting on an investment committee that was looking at those opportunities from those perspectives of different asset classes. So different risk return profiles, different market dynamics, different fund dynamics across those asset classes. That was interesting foundationally to really understand that, because it didn't put private equity or even venture capital in a vacuum. You're kind of looking at it already from a variety of different investment and risk return profile perspectives. So that I found was like a good perspective to have coming into the VC fund of funds at SAP, which is became Sapphire Ventures. It rebranded quickly after I got there, and now is known as Sapphire Partners in the market. Being kind of early there and seeing the growth trajectory, I think helped inform where I wanted to spend my time, which was in the emerging manager camp. And emerging managers mean, I think, different things to different people. In venture capital, it's usually defined as sub 200. I think it's more recently defined as sub $100 million funds. And even more recently, there's kind of new trends with nano funds. So very small funds, and those are usually sub 25 or sub 15. So it's always a gray line where that number is. But you know, I became interested in the emerging manager camp and realized that there were a lot of good investors in the market, and you know, they were coming to the market from different places. They were, you know, spinning out of investment firms. They were, you know, building companies and you know, getting excited about investing, and they start doing a little bit of investing, and then they start to formalize that practice. And there were even, you know, given the specialization of the venture market, there were even firms and people coming out of, you know, traditional corporates, or they were coming from a different background, but they had this specialized skill set that made them valuable to VC-backed companies. And so they, you know, were building up track records. And, you know, the whole point of saying all that is, you know, there were a lot of managers that needed help kind of understanding this, you know, whole body of knowledge related to, you know, what it meant to build a firm. And, you know, I was in a fortunate position for a number of years investing into, again, a number of very good, well-run, you know, best practices, private equity and venture capital firms. And it felt like the gap was between, you know, how these firms were run very well and what emerging managers needed to actually, again, build the infrastructure, build the operational best practices, build their firms effectively. And so I spent, you know, the last 3 years kind of building out that vision, like what does that actually look like? And you know, what it's turned into is a cohort-based educational program and community for emerging managers. So we work with venture capital funds, debt funds, and actually growth funds now that come through this program. And they're very early. You know, sometimes they're pre-setting up their fund and they come through this program. Sometimes they already have a fund or two under their belt, but they're still, you know, early and what some would call pre-institutional. They haven't taken like a large institutional check from an endowment or foundation or an OCIO or a pension fund or something like that yet. But they, you know, they go through this extensive application process. You know, we mutually decide whether it's a good fit to come into the community. And then it's centered around this educational program. And I'm currently on the third cohort. There's, you know, 62 funds that are in the community at the moment. And so it's a way to help that emerging manager community, mainly in VC, but again, starting to, you know, look at other strategies as well. It's helping those VCs really, again, understand what it means to be a fund manager, be the CEO of their VC firm, and build a great institutional firm.
Right. That's super exciting. And thanks for sharing that background, very diverse experience that you've got going from the institutional level VCs and now working with emerging fund managers. That's very exciting. So from personal experience, being in, you know, serial entrepreneur myself, then getting into angel investing and had multiple opportunities, and now we're managing an SPVs where we invest as a smaller group of technology execs into other startups. A lot of conversations also shape around just more of a formalized venture capital fund and the role of a limited partner. And when you operate on a much smaller scale as a small SPV or just doing angel investing, you don't necessarily think about the kind of the role of the limited partner and just how the whole structure, you know, is all about. So when you work with the emerging fund managers or anyone that you advise on, when it comes to just building that relationship and the overall structure, how you collaborate with the LPs, what are some of the most common pitfalls that you observe that the emerging fund managers make? And what are some of the recommendations that you provide from that perspective?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's more nuanced than that. So, I think you come to venture investing from different paths, right? And even people that are spinning out of large established firms don't necessarily have the insight into how those firms are run on a day-to-day basis. So again, like there's investment expertise. You have investors that are very good at sourcing. Again, they're on a platform, so they've been able to leverage that platform to the advantage of, you know, winning those companies. And many times, you know, they're sitting on boards and, you know, they're experts in, you know, how to manage boards, how to provide, you know, governance and advice to startups. And so you have, like, again, I think that's the cookie cutter approach to VC. Like that's what that's the profile of what a lot of institutional LPs will look for, is that, you know, quote unquote spin out from an established fund. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, even those individuals, again, like that, if that's like the traditional bar for institutional LPs to invest, is someone that has traditional established VC fund experience investing. Those folks, again, like they don't necessarily have insight into the day-to-day of operations or what it means to manage LP relationships or what it means to fully run a fundraising practice or fundraising process. And those processes can take place over, you know, if you're really good, 2 to 3 months. If you're kind of, you know, doing it at a normal pace, let's call it, you know, 12 to 18 months. I say all this because, like, that's the traditional approach, but, like, there are other routes into venture now. Venture, like, the background of an investor is more diversified by experience. And so you don't necessarily have to follow that traditional path. And so I think because like, even if you have, like, these established VC fund spinouts, you know, misunderstanding or not fully appreciating, like, the nuance of everything that goes on in the LP-GP relationship, the people that have, you know, no exposure to that, like, it's not surprising that, you know, they do run into pitfalls or there is, like, a lack of understanding of what is the LP world look like. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a common misperception, and maybe it's framed as, like, what is the LP, right? It's not a monolith. It's actually, like, a bunch of individuals, many times agents that are, you know, investing on other people's behalf as well. And again, like, they're looking for, you know, certain things, you know, at times in VC, but many times outside of VC. And I think you have to appreciate, I think, the nuance of their investment strategy, like who they are as people, and develop, like, an empathy and understanding of, like, what different types of LPs are looking for. And it's not the same. So I think, like, if we're drilling down into, like, common pitfalls, I think it does many times, like, stem there, where it's like, okay, this is a very different ecosystem and a very different market than what you're doing on the day to day, especially if you're coming from an operational background or you're coming from an angel investing background, like, and you're working directly with founders, like, the pacing can be different. The terminology can be different. Like, the cultural dynamics of, like, how you build relationships can be different. Right. Like, the reporting is different. Like, there's so many different things, between, like, the GP and the LP versus, like, the GP and the founder. And I think identifying those and getting up to speed on those is a learning curve. And it's like, how quickly can you do that learning curve? And I think in the past, the answer has been years, right? If you're lucky and you already are connected to the right people that know the best practices and are willing to spend time, you know, being your mentor, which is why, like, I think, you know, there's a place for operator, because it's an 8-week program and I've spent years sort of figuring out what the curriculum should be. Mm-hmm. Or at least having an opinion on what the curriculum should be. And now it's been iterated on, you know, by 62, you know, funds that have said, like, yes, this is super helpful. Or, you know, you should add this, or you should think about this perspective. And it's just like, I think it's that iterative process where, what is the comprehensive set of knowledge you need to know to really fundamentally understand this ecosystem between the GP and the LP. And I think, I think that does require, like, a certain personality of individual. Like, they have to be open to learning. They have to be, you know, understanding that there, you know, are different dynamics between the GP and the LP and the GP and the founder. And they have to be, yeah, open to committing time to really understand this new market, right? Mm-hmm. It's if you're in, you know, IT development, and then you go into, you know, healthcare services, like that's a different market. And so I think like sort of taking that mindset and applying it to, you know, I have this relationship with all these founders. I'm a rock star building relationships with them, and I'm very helpful to them. But like, what does it mean to do this other thing? I think it's like another set of skills, management skills in particular, that you need to develop in order to, you know, really, really shine and stand out in the market. And that's, I guess, my hypothesis on like running this program in the first place is I think it, you know, can be helpful for fund managers, you know, to be able to differentiate themselves. And so when they come through this, that's been the feedback from the first two cohorts. The, you know, third cohort is currently ongoing. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of like identifying all of those things, I think really allows you to address the pitfalls up front. And the last thing I'll say on this is, you know, there are sort of, you know, many common pitfalls. We can go into others if you want, but like the general recommendation is to try to learn as quickly as possible, like the comprehensive set of what it is you need to manage and understand. And I think the way this comes out is you don't know what you don't know. And so how do you get to know it faster? Like you can go through the process, you can learn it. It most likely will take you years, or you can try to accelerate that learning curve. And then you're not going to be the perfect VC at the end of that, right? But you're going to at least know what to manage, at least have better perspective on like what it means to run a, you know, fully institutional setup. And I think that's sometimes lacking, even if you've, you know, again, knocked it out of the park on your track record, and you're a really good investor already. There's these other parts of the business that I think are important, and maybe not everyone agrees with me on that, but there are other parts of the business that are super important and become part of your fiduciary responsibility if you're definitely going to, you know, start managing other people's money. It's a very different ball game than angel investing.
Right. Absolutely. Definitely interesting perspectives. And take that a little bit further. When it comes to fundraising for the emerging fund managers, especially those that have never, you know, managed the funds before, I would imagine a lot of those folks that you work with directly, I correlate that also to that experience as a founder operator going through the fundraising route, working with the investors. And to me, the interesting kind of concept and just the entities of that relationship between the founder and the investor also kind of correlates between the GP and the LP that they pitch to. So the question that I have is in terms of being selective as a GP and selecting very strategic LPs that you want as part of your fund, but balancing that with those that may not necessarily fit your theme, but they do have the capital available to invest into your fund. What are your thoughts just overall in kind of managing that balance between being extremely selective and targeting specific profile of an LP that will help your fund vision and strategy versus also going more generalist route and just taking on, I guess, anyone who is willing to invest?
Yeah, I think there's a few things there. One, in an ideal world, it'd be great if you could just pick the LPs that you want. Like that should be the aspiration and the goal. And maybe that's what homeostasis looks like in 5 or 10 years, mm-hmm. right? So there's always going to be this trade-off. And the same is probably true with any startup, right? It's kind of, oh, if I could have my pick of customer lists, like who's the perfect customer? Right. But then you know, you break apart your customers or, you know, you deconstruct your customers and you're like, well, this one's really good. Right. But this one takes a lot of my time. And so I think, you know, you're always having that trade-off and especially it's especially true for emerging managers. I think what you're asking is interesting though, because it's starting to dig into what is your fundraising strategy? And again, if we're kind of keeping on the theme of like common pitfalls, like this is probably a common pitfall. Like I would argue that most emerging managers do not have a fundraising strategy. And I think that might stem from what I was mentioning earlier, which is, you know, do you understand GP-LP dynamics? Do you understand the LP world? Do you understand the nuances of different types of LPs? And so if you don't even have that initial perspective, it's very hard to get to, you know, teasing out, oh, I know what my fundraising strategy, and I can actually build a strategy around like going after kind of the people aligned with my vision who are going to be super important for that. And there are funds built off of that. Like their LP base is exclusively, you know, healthcare if they're a healthcare fund, or cyber if they're a cyber fund. And so you do have these specialized funds that have specialized LP bases. And I do think there are corporates looking for that. Like there are, you know, specialized companies or corporates that are, you know, they have defined strategies, like they know what they're looking for. So aligning with really good investors who are very good at sourcing and getting access into these great opportunities. Like they're, I think I would say it's on both sides, where like the corporate LPs and LPs that have some strategic interest are definitely out there looking for that. I think it's tough to kind of come across the right individual or the right team, especially when they're an emerging manager and there's still, you know, a lot of things like they have to put into place to be viewed as institutional. But I think that's out there. And so I think, you know, from the GP's perspective, you know, honing in on who those groups are, understanding what their motivations are, understanding what their strategies are, like that's starting to like get into, I think the deeper appreciation for what a fundraising strategy actually is. And they're tough to come by, right? I think one of the gaps I saw before starting Operator was, you know, I talked to the LPs and the LPs are like, I think that these emerging managers need, you know, ABC and XYZ. And then you talk to the GPs and they're just like, I need more top of funnel. I just need to like close more LPs, right? And so I think that's a disconnect where it's like, is the GP self-aware enough to know like where they are in their own journey of becoming an investor, becoming an institutional firm? And have they built something that's attractive enough, institutionalized enough, process-driven, that's going to be attractive to, again, those LPs that are seeking those specialized opportunities? And I would say, again, like maybe one more thing here is, I would say, again, like there's a lot of LPs trying to understand in emerging managers, like what is different about this individual or this team, right? And I think many times in today's market, like differentiation comes across as specialization. And so if you're able to, again, like on the GP side, appreciate those folks who are looking for specialized strategies and viewing that as differentiation. And then you have LPs like out there who are willing and most likely driven by mandates and other preferences or strategic goals. I think that's when you start to actually hone in on like who your ideal LP is. And as a GP, like I think you can hone your fundraising strategy at that point. And so I wouldn't, going back to the start, like I wouldn't say it's like the GPs can be super, super selective, but they have to start like figuring out like what's their fundraising strategy, who's the ideal LP, iterate on that, ask those questions. And if you can do that again, like in a process-driven way, in a way that's, you know, self-aware and you're starting to hone in on like who really likes what you're doing, I think that's a better way to approach it. And then it's really up to, for the GP, you know, at the end of the day to figure out, you know, does it make sense for me to partner with this LP or not? Because again, like going back to the customer analogy, like, is it a customer that's going to understand what I'm doing and they're going to like, you know, sort of help me in this journey? They're going to be accretive, or is it someone that I'm going to have to spend a ton of time getting up to speed. They're going to be asking a lot of stuff and they're not really going to understand like what the actual, you know, GP LP dynamics look like. And that's going to hurt your business more than help it, even if it does come with, you know, a little bit of capital.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with you on that, to really take that a little bit step back in the sense to understand and define the strategy of the type of LP you want to target and really try to look from their lens in the sense, what are my objectives as an LP and am I fitting that particular investment strategy or investment thesis that this fund is all about? I think that's definitely an interesting approach. There's not enough, I guess, conversations around LPACs. And the reason I ask that is because, at least from my own lens, not enough of that. When through my conversations with LPs and just looking at it from the LP perspective, from their lens, the role of the LPAC when it comes to just being part of, integral part of the fund, share any thoughts on that. What is your view on the role of the committee? Is it necessary? And what are the different roles that really play from LP perspective as they decide to form that LPAC for that particular fund?
Yeah. So my experience here, I've participated as an institutional LP in LPAC conversations with over 20 firms. And I'm actually formally on a couple of LPACs at the moment. I think the role of the LPAC is vastly underappreciated in the emerging manager world, where I'm spending a lot of time right now. I would say most emerging managers do not have LPACs. They may have, I would say the majority do have some type of structure, but it's not as formal as an LPAC, where they're leaning on advisors to help them. And many times that looks very informal. It's kind of an ad hoc call with a mentor, or you know what they'll call, you know, an advisor to, you know, figure out problems as they arise. So it's much more informal, but I think the LPAC is really there to ensure that you're being a strong fiduciary. Like, you know, you're managing the LPAC members' capital well, but you're also, you know, managing the capital on all LPs' behalf well. And I think this is where I see actually where the venture market has grown. And I think the idea of governance has taken a hit, and the idea of managing, or maybe the concept of managing, like conflicts of interest has really taken a hit. And so, you know, where I view the LPAC, it's mature emerging managers who realize that like governance adds alpha to the equation. Like it can help with your outperformance. Managing conflicts of interest can help with relationship building, especially long-term relationship building, and avoiding issues that are potentially going to like hurt your firm in the medium and long-term, right? And relying on a group of individuals that have seen a number of permutations of how things have played out, or at least can provide you like thoughtful perspective. And at the end of the day, it's the GP making the decision. But, you know, you can lean on these very sophisticated LPs, experienced LPs, LPs that, again, like have probably seen this issue in the past, very similar to how a board member plays a role at a startup company, right? Like many times founders appreciate an experienced board member because they've seen the issue before and can provide valuable perspective on like, you know, what the path could be, or, you know, what's happened in the past and what has actually played out when, you know, that founder has made that decision. So very similar here. It's kind of, you know, what are the big picture things that could positively or negatively impact the firm? And let's talk about those, and let me as an emerging manager take some accountability and discuss those with an outside group, right? And again, I think, you know, you've seen this change now where I would say 5 years ago, there were a number of LPs, especially like, you know, I would say better known LPs that categorically would not invest into solo GPs. And it was for this reason. I think it was, you know, part decision-making, like, do you have partners around the table that are gonna like push back and help you, you know, kind of see your own gaps in the decision-making process. But I think another part is kind of, you know, governance. Like, you know, what does the back office look like? You know, what is the financial controls look like? And maybe part of it is time as well, right? Like this is going to be really interesting for one fund, but once fund two and fund three are layered in, like that might be a little bit different. So I think, you know, all of a sudden, like fast forward, you have a lot of those LPs who've kind of turned around and now said, oh, well, the market has changed such where there's a lot of really good solo GPs and now I want to invest in solo GPs. So they've kind of, you know, pushed some of that under the rug. But the point is on the LPAC, like there's still, it's still interesting, even if you're a solo GP, to like have a formal governance structure, right? Like it's not necessarily a partner that's helping with decision-making on the investment side, but it is a partner or partners on the LPAC that are helping with decision-making on things that are related to your organization, are related to fund controls, are related to, you know, the legal contracts you signed with the LPs in the first place, are related to conflicts of interest. And, you know, I think keeping the cadence right, you know, it doesn't have to happen a lot. It should happen maybe twice a year. Or, you know, if there's something really pressing, you know, having that experienced, you know, set of partners that you can call on and can provide perspective in real time. I think that's the way I see, with emerging managers, at least the cadence. But yeah, I think some people have LPACs for the sole reason of driving ego at the LP level. Like they're just like, oh, you want to be on the LPAC? Well, you should come on the LPAC. And then someone gets on the LPAC and they don't know how to use it. So it just like sits there versus like the GP recognizing, oh, this is a potential conflict of interest. I'm doing a cross fund investment and I have different LPs in fund one and fund two. I should call together the LPAC and discuss with them like what that looks like. How should I think about that? Like, what are the issues there? And try to understand like, what's the comfort level? Like what's going to be the pushback? And it's really, again, it's in the vein of like relationship building and being a good actor. And so I think, you know, using the LPAC to get kind of a sense of that, of, you know, how are LPs going to be thinking about this? How is that going to affect kind of the next fund? How is it going to affect, you know, my current standing with not only the LPAC members, but other LPs, you know? And again, if you run into a few of those issues and you don't manage them well, let's say between the course of fund one and fund two, you are going to run into some pushback where, you know, maybe there were some hurt feelings, or maybe there, you know, even worse, like there were, you know, some structural disadvantages created and some poor acting on behalf of the GP that could have been solved through like the smart use of an LPAC.
You've chosen a very, very niche space to play in. You know, it's, you're a coach in the league where teams of emerging fund managers play. And just curious, from a personal perspective, what's the motivation behind that? Why do you want to help the emerging fund managers? What is the opportunity that you see there? And also kind of, what is the longer term vision for the operator?
Yeah. I think it's fun to win. And I think it's fun to win, especially if you're the underdog, you know, and I think everyone loves the underdog story, but it is that probably two things. Like one, or maybe it's three things. One, it's like, what is venture capital? And like, having done this for over 10 years now, you know, that's not a long time, but it's enough time to gain the view that venture capital is risk capital. It's taking on risk very early in opportunities that can have a huge impact. And I think framing it that way and looking at the market that way, it does feel like the emerging managers in many cases are taking on that risk and this is probably an unpopular opinion, where you have a lot of the larger AUM firms are more growth capital, where they're not necessarily taking that early risk, right? And so you have this compounding of risks in emerging managers where it's very hard to build the firm. You are overlooked and underappreciated. And yet you're probably a group of individuals that's working harder than anyone else to make sure that these founders are winning. And that's like, when I'm talking about winning, it's like actually building a real company, which is just like an absolute slog. And so where I find alignment and, you know, why I chose this was, it feels like the real venture capitalists are the emerging managers focused like super early. And the people that, and maybe this is my own bias because it's, you know, where I'm spending a lot of time and the people I'm talking with the most, but it feels like the people working exceptionally hard to make founders' lives easier are these gems that are emerging managers that also want to build a company, and they want to build it in service of the founders. And in doing so, like, they're having just an immensely difficult time getting it off the ground from fund one to fund two to fund three. And then all of a sudden, like, if they're winning at that time, then like, it's obvious for institutional LPs. And they're like, oh, of course. So like, I'm going to invest in this person. Like, it's kind of like how decision-making sometimes plays out at VC firms, where it's like, who's actually building conviction in the actual company, right? If like success has 10 fathers or 10 mothers or whatever the saying is, right? After the fact, it's like, oh, this is so obvious. Like, yeah, definitely like the person that like built conviction in this like early founder. But it's like, did you? This person's been working on the concept for like 3 or 4 years. Like, that's a long time to be going through like mental anguish as a founder. And then all of a sudden, like, it starts to work and everyone wants to like pour capital into your company. But I don't think you fully appreciate like the kind of grit of the first few years when you're an emerging manager. It's the same way. It's like, these people are, from my perspective, and this is why people call, I think, operator the YC for funds. It's because they're CEOs of their own firm. And like, they're building something special, but it's in service of the founder. And so I thought like that was a gap where I do think it's differentiated to kind of play in that gap. And there have been copycats now, people that are basically just, you know, ripping off the model, which is fine because there needs to be more support for emerging managers. But, you know, the idea here was to identify like what the gap was. It was finding these like founder VCs that, you know, just needed to win themselves because they wanted to build something really special for founders. And like, that part of the ecosystem is very special because it's the capital network, it's the capital markets of actual venture capitalists. And I think like playing kind of this, you know, behind the scenes role of helping those people that are helping the founders in an instrumental way, like, who's the founder going to call to actually like get good advice? And those people struggling on the day to day, it's like, okay, well, there's a gap here. You have great people helping founders. Who's actually helping the founders of the founders, or like the founder VCs helping the founders? And so, yeah, it's definitely like a niche role. But I think like that was kind of the impetus behind creating this and kind of, you know, what gets me excited. And then to answer the second part of your question on longer term vision, I just don't know. I think, you know, I try to help emerging VCs. It seems like I've been able to be helpful now at scale, you know, across two, you know, going on three cohorts. People seem to think this is a very helpful program. So, you know, I'll continue to run it in that vein. And then we'll kind of see like how it scales up. And I think, yeah, one potential way to think about it is, just like, again, who's building conviction early and being the most helpful support mechanism to these emerging managers in the early days. And, you know, if I can execute on that vision, then I think there's, you know, going to be options to scale up.
That's pretty cool. I like that a lot. Going from that trickle to the torrent, I think that's super exciting to see anytime you're part of that, to help either an emerging fund manager or even the startup from that perspective. I think that's very exciting. Winter, in closure, what are your most kind of, I'm not going to ask for one, but your favorite, the pieces of advice that you've received throughout your career from your mentors, your advisors, what are some of the go-to kind of pieces of thoughts that you revert to on a continuous basis?
Yeah, it's a great question. I should think on it more. I think there are like moments in people's lives that are instrumental, and maybe it's just like a passing moment. They don't like fully reflect on it. And I know like if I try to answer this question, like I'm going to miss times or pieces of advice that were probably more instrumental than others. I think the first piece of advice was just like more a, I think it just had to do with like confidence. And so one was in high school where, you know, one of my advisors basically just gave me like the confidence or gave me more confidence in like what the college experience could be like, right? And kind of, I think if I missed that conversation, I would have like missed kind of the full potential of myself and like the ability to actually, you know, I would have undersold myself in terms of like where I set my sights for college. And so like, it was just an important, the piece of advice was just like giving me the right perspective on what I could achieve personally. And I think, again, it wasn't like a, you know, a phrase or anything. It was just like that moment of confidence. I think, you know, that's played out a few times, where maybe that's from my experience of like growing up on a farm and not having like full worldly cosmopolitan perspective, at the start of things. But I think like going through this journey of life and having people at times like splice in and say, hey, you actually are pretty decent at what you're doing. Maybe you should think about something more than what you're thinking about at the moment, right? So I think that probably runs culturally in line with what I'm doing now. It's kind of helping emerging managers gain perspective in the world of LP versus the journey of life. But I think like that's probably like the most instrumental piece. So it's not necessarily like a piece of advice per se, but it's more of like, what are the moments that allow you to broaden your perspective, like actually, and like when people talk about leveling up, like what does that actually mean? I think those are probably like the most impactful pieces. Cause again, it makes you become a better decision maker. If you have broader perspective, and it's not necessarily a piece of advice, like a piece of advice to me sometimes is like someone telling you what to do and you kind of like take their advice. But I think what's more interesting is like, if you can broaden your perspective, so you actually strengthen your decision-making framework and make better decisions ultimately, where you're not like boxed into suboptimal decisions, but you broaden your perspective so that like you make just, you know, more optimal decisions, which actually like, you know, accelerate or improve kind of your positioning.
Winter, I can't thank you enough for such an insightful conversation. What I love doing with all the guests on Ivy Podcast is do a follow-up recording in about a year where we revisit the conversation from a year ago to see everything that we've discussed, if everything still makes sense, still applies. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you today, you know, in about a year. Yeah, and really appreciate your time today. It was very informative. Thank you for that.
Thanks, John.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.